Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. The Taiwanese president has promised to defend his country after China launched military drills around the island. A purge of the Russian military is continuing with the arrest of the deputy chief of general staff. And in northern Mexico, a stage has collapsed at an election rally, killing at least 9 people. Also in this podcast, President Emmanuel Macron, on a visit to the riot-hit territory of New Caledonia, says French police will remain for as long as necessary. And as the UK gets into general election campaign mode, we'll hear from our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
The politicians are now crisscrossing the country for votes. They face a weary and sceptical electorate, many of whom think Britain isn't working.
And we begin in Taiwan, where President William Lai has promised to defend freedom and democracy as China conducts military exercises around the island.
I will stand on the front line with all the brothers and sisters from the National Army to defend peace. We will continue to defend the values of democracy, protecting regional peace and stability.
Well, China holding military drills around Taiwan is nothing new, but the latest ones appear to have an added touch of menace. Beijing is simulating a full-scale attack and has described the exercises as strong punishment for what it calls Taiwan's separatist acts. The two-day drills come 3 days after the inauguration of Taiwan's new president. China regards Taiwan as a breakaway province. Sun Lifeng is a spokesman for the Taiwanese Defence Ministry.
This irrational provocation has jeopardized regional peace and stability. PRC's dispatch of aircraft and vessels harassing its neighbors in recent years has threatened global peace and stability.
Stephen McDonnell is our Beijing correspondent, and he had this assessment.
Well, this is as much about political pressure as it is about genuine military preparation. When you look at the maps that have been provided by the PLA, you can see the zones where these exercises are taking place, and they're all around Taiwan, effectively encircling Taiwan. One way of looking at this is that it shows the people in Taiwan, if we want to, we the PLA, if we wanted to blockade you, we could. We could stop goods from coming in and, in a way, eventually force you to unify with the mainland because you'd have no choice. You'd be cut off from the outside world. Another thing it enables the PLA to do is to get ready for an attack, an invasion. And there's landing craft involved, rocket forces involved. But if this was seriously the PLA doing this as a dress rehearsal for an invasion, well, in a sense, you're telegraphing your punches. And the Taiwanese military has sat back and said, well, we're just going to use the next 2 days to collect all the intelligence we possibly can. And in that way, thank you very much. We can see how you're preparing to invade us and we'll prepare accordingly.
We've heard from the deputy commander of the US Indo-Pacific Command. He described it all as concerning but not unexpected. What might the impact of this be?
I think it's meant to put pressure on the government in Taiwan and I guess people in Taiwan indirectly. The timing of it's no coincidence. It's just days after the inauguration of the new president. This is a leader from a party that Beijing doesn't like. They see him as more in favour of Taiwanese independence, if you put it that way, rather than some form of unity eventually with mainland China. But if the goal of the PLA was to freak out the general population, if I could put it to you that way, one thing that would indicate it maybe hasn't worked is the data we're getting on Google searches in Taiwan today. Now, what are Taiwanese looking at today? Are they looking up all this stuff to do with the military drills? No. What they're searching for is information on a famous Japanese actor who apparently is being accused of infidelity with his wife. So this is what's really on the minds of people in Taiwan today. I guess they're becoming quite blasé about these exercises. And in a way, Beijing then has two options. It can either keep ratcheting up these exercises to make them more serious, or find another means of trying to pressure people in Taiwan to somehow or other come round to thinking they would want to reunify with the mainland. But given all the research that's been done on that, on the thoughts of people in Taiwan, I think that's a very, very tough thing for them to do.
Stephen McDonnell. Now to Russia, where another general has been arrested as what appears to be a purge of the military continues. Vadim Shamarin, the deputy chief of general staff, has appeared in court accused of taking bribes. He's the fourth senior official to be arrested since April. Earlier this month, President Putin appointed the economist and former deputy prime minister Andrei Belousov as defense minister. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov denied that a purge was underway.
The fight against corruption is consistent work. It's not a campaign. It's constantly ongoing work. It's an integral part of the activities of our law enforcement agencies. I cannot give any details as I'm not authorized to do it, but it is not a campaign.
Nikki Cardwell is our Europe regional editor.
This is the fourth senior military arrest that we've seen since the end of April. We know that when he was arrested, his house was searched and he's already appeared in court charged with large-scale bribery. And as you say, that's a 15-year sentence if he's convicted. It is the latest in this chain that we're seeing. He's less high profile. The important thing is what he does. He is in charge of procurement and communication and getting a lot of stuff to the troops on the front line. So clearly that's the area that they've been looking at with him.
And the new minister very much playing to his strengths.
He is indeed. When he was appointed, people pointed out that he actually didn't have any military experience at all. He'd never served a day. He's an economist and was a civil servant. He's come up through the civil service. One of the quotes I've seen from people who know him is that he's not corrupt, that he is one of the most honest men they've ever come across. So in terms of what Vladimir Putin wanted to do in rooting out some of the corruption that has been endemic in the army procurement system, he was clearly the man that he wanted for that job.
And what is the Kremlin saying about him, about the other sackings and arrests? And what does it mean going forward for the conduct of the Ukraine war?
Well, we have had something from Dmitry Peskov, who is the Kremlin spokesman. He spoke to journalists this morning and denied that it was a purge. He said this is just part of the role of law and order. And he said that the fight against corruption would continue in all departments. Now, what this means for Ukraine, if you remember at the beginning of the war, there was a lot of criticism online, particularly about the inability to get stuff to the front line. And this is part of the process of trying to improve that.
That was Nikki Cardwell. Here in the UK, the first full day of political campaigning ahead of the general election is well underway. With the vote set for July the 4th, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, toured broadcasting studios on Thursday morning. On BBC Radio, he was asked why he had called the election now.
I'm not claiming for a second that the job is done. And yes, you're right, there is still more work to do. But when I came into this job, my overriding priority was to bring economic stability back. And we have done that. It's taken time. It's taken tough decisions that weren't easy and people criticised, but I stuck to it because I believed it was right for our country. And now inflation is back to normal, thanks to everyone's hard work and collective sacrifice.
Mr. Sunak will now go on a two-day tour of all four UK nations. The opposition Labour Party leader Keir Starmer kicked off his campaign in the Conservative heartland of Kent in South East England.
This election is about a choice. Two different countries, two different futures. Decline and chaos continuing under Tories or rebuilding our country under Labour. The power of the vote is with you. If you want change, you have to vote for it. And if you vote Labour, it's a vote to stop the chaos. It's a vote to turn the page. And it's a vote to rebuild our country together.
So how different are the two main party leaders' visions for the country? Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, told us more from Downing Street.
They're very different in the sense that you've essentially got an argument from the Conservatives, which is that better the devil you know. We're on the right track. Stick with us. Versus the classic argument in elections, which is that it is a time for a change. And I think that is going to be the entire dynamic for the next 5 or 6 weeks, with the Conservatives claiming, look, you know, there is somewhat better news on the economy. Would you really want to risk anything in a sort of difficult, unstable world on an untested opposition? And you'll get Keir Starmer and the rest of the Labour Party repeatedly asking the British people, look, after 14 years of Conservative government, do you feel better off or do you think it's time for change?
And of course, journalists love elections, but what's the mood like in the country? What about the electorate?
The politicians are going to be up against a very unhappy electorate, and polling survey after polling survey and anecdotal evidence, Jackie, suggests two things. First of all, that large majorities of the British population think that somehow the country is on the wrong track, that things have gone wrong, things aren't working properly. But secondly, and this is the real complication for the politicians, the surveys also suggest that British people are just incredibly negative about the system, about political leaders, including Mr. Starmer and Mr. Sunak, and about the political parties themselves. So as they crisscross the country, as they're starting to do, they're really going to be up against it.
And we've heard from Labour and the Conservatives. What about the other parties on the campaign trail?
Yes, it's important to remember that opinion polling suggests that maybe as many as the third of the electorate are going to look to smaller parties such as the Green Party, to the Liberal Democrats, to the Nationalist parties in Scotland and in Wales, and of course to an insurgent right-wing party called Reform. So they'll all be making the case none of the above. But I think the sort of political scepticism, cynicism and weariness, I think it extends to all parties on behalf of the British electorate.
That was Rob Watson. The families of the 19 children and two teachers killed in a school shooting in Texas 2 years ago have settled for $2 million compensation from the city of Uvalde. Now, $2 million might not seem much compensation for their loss, but Lilia Luciano, a correspondent for our partners CBS News, who's in Uvalde, explained why.
This settlement, while low, is made in the attempt to mend, to heal the divisions that have existed in this community since those families went through the trauma of losing those 19 children and two teachers. At first, the community came together, but of course, the calls for accountability began once the videos started emerging and more information made it to the public that law enforcement had waited 77 minutes between the moment that the shooter entered a classroom and the moment that they finally breached the door and stopped him by killing him. The children, in the meantime, were calling 911, hiding from him. And of course, that police response has led to a great deal of questions, activism demands for accountability. That has caused some divisions. That and the calls for gun control reforms in the U.S. that these families have been in the forefront of. And so, because of those divisions within the local community, families did not want to financially burden their community, their city. Therefore, they are settling for $2 million. It comes from the insurance of the city. That said, they're also filing a $500 million lawsuit against the state of Texas because it was the state of Texas's police, DPS is the agency, the one police agency that had the highest, the greatest number of officers present during that time that children were in there waiting to be saved. They're also suing Motorola, which manufactures the police radios, which failed during that process, as well as the incident commander, who was an employee of the school district, the school principal, and others. We're hearing that maybe there's going to be another settlement with the county here in Uvalde. But these families, as much as they want to mend the relationship with their neighbors, are still loudly calling for accountability as we approach the 2-year mark of this horrific massacre tomorrow.
Lilia Luciano. Still to come in this podcast.
This isn't just a treasure with economic value. It's more than that. It has cultural importance.
Colombia seals off the site of an 18th century warship which went down loaded with treasure. Now to Mexico. The moment just after a stage collapsed at an election event, causing panic as people scrambled to escape. At least 9 people were killed and dozens more hurt as a heavy storm tore through the stage. A presidential candidate, Jorge Álvarez Maínez, was on stage as it collapsed.
It was a freak event, because normally the weather gives some warning as it intensifies. But what we experienced happened in just a few seconds. A gale came, a sudden wind, and it collapsed the stage, resulting in a fatal accident.
Our correspondent David Willis has been monitoring events from Los Angeles.
This incident occurred at a baseball field near the northern Mexico city of Monterrey. High winds are thought to have caused part of the stage that was accommodating a rally for Mexico's centrist Citizens Movement Party to collapse. Now, harrowing video footage posted to social media shows that party's presidential candidate, Jorge Álvarez Maínez, waving to his chanting and cheering supporters and then running for safety as a giant screen and other parts of the structure toppled over. Now, Mr. Maínez and several members of his campaign team were taken to hospital but subsequently released. There are unconfirmed reports that some people were buried after the structure toppled over. Now, Mr. Maínez, who's 38 years old, is currently at third place in the presidential polls, some way behind the leading candidate, Claudia Steinbaum, who is the former mayor of Mexico City and a member of the Morena Party of Mexico.
That was David Willis. In July 1995, Bosnian Serb forces rounded up and killed some 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys in the small town of Srebrenica. Many see it as the worst single atrocity in Europe since the Second World War. Now the UN is preparing to vote on a resolution which calls for an annual international day to mark the Srebrenica massacre. But the resolution, backed by Germany and Rwanda, countries with dark histories of genocide of their own, faces opposition from Serbians and Bosnian Serbs, including the Serbian Orthodox Church. Bells rang out as churches joined the protest. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay told us more about what happened in Srebrenica.
Well, it was the single worst day of the conflicts that broke out during the implosion of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. The Dutch UN battalion, which had been protecting Bosniak Muslims in and around Srebrenica, were in essence overwhelmed by Bosnian Serb forces. And at the time, those Bosnian Serb forces said they meant no harm to the people that had been under the protection of the United Nations. But they very swiftly divided them between men and boys and women. And many of these men and boys were taken away and never seen again. They were massacred in several different locations over the course of not just the 11th of July, but a couple of the following days as well. And people have been trying to find justice and find reconciliation and find some sort of closure ever since.
And this UN resolution is about creating an international day to mark the Srebrenica massacre. Tell us more about the protests against that idea, particularly by the Orthodox Church.
Well, it's a day that's meant to be a day of remembrance for victims of the genocide at Srebrenica. It specifically says genocide. And it's worth noting that because people have been found guilty at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague of the offence of genocide. That includes Ratko Mladic, the former military chief of the Bosnian Serbs, and Radovan Karadzic, the political leader. Now, they've been held individually responsible. But what you've got in Serbia over and over again over the years is politicians who talk about people trying to find Serbia and Serbians collectively responsible for genocide. Now, this resolution isn't saying that at all, but nonetheless, it's being used by politicians in Republika Srpska, which is the majority Serb part of Bosnia, and within Serbia itself, to claim, really, that people around the world have got it in for them somehow. And the Orthodox Church, which is very close to the Serbian government, is joining in, ringing those bells, Patriarch Porfiria calling the faithful people to prayer to go on and do good despite completely false and unjust accusations to which the Serbian people are exposed in the United Nations.
That was Guy Delaunay. President Macron has flown 17,000 kilometres to New Caledonia to take personal control of the crisis in the French Pacific Territory, which is under a state of emergency. Six people, including two police officers, have been killed in unrest, started by pro-independence groups angry at French government plans to widen voting rights to more non-native people. Mr. Macron said extra police deployed from France would stay as long as necessary.
My wish here with the ministers and the government is to be at the side of the population so that, as quickly as possible, we have the return of peace, calm and security. That's the main priority.
There have long been tensions between the central government in Paris and indigenous Kanaks, who make up 40% of the population of New Caledonia. Our correspondent in the region is Katie Watson.
It's going to be an incredibly hard visit for the time he's got there. Now, he said he wants to try and bring some peace and stability. He also wants to acknowledge the economic challenges. It's a country hard hit by difficult economic situation the last few years. But I think his biggest challenge will be the political challenge, trying to talk about a future for New Caledonia, bring two sides who are very far apart together and try and work on moving on from the unrest that we've seen, you know, hit the country in the last, what, nearly 2 weeks.
And just looking at that unrest, remind us, what was it that triggered it? Why are these various groups so angry?
So what triggered it was a debate in Parliament in France to allow French people who've been living in New Caledonia for about a decade to be able to take part in local elections. But the concern from Indigenous Kanaks is that that will dilute their political influence. And this goes back a long way. This isn't a tension that's just started. Back in 1998, there was the Noumea Accord that was drawn up, which basically set New Caledonia towards a path of more autonomy, more political power for Indigenous Kanaks. And in that, there were referendums as well that were tabled. There were three referendums. The first two were quite a narrow majority, but it was a majority to remain French. And then in 2021, in the wake of COVID, there was another one that pro-independence leaders, they boycotted. They said that it was rushed through. Therefore, that's kind of set the tone of tension in the last few years. So the concern is that France is basically trying to take on perhaps too much power and influence when there are a large group of people that would like more independence from France.
As you say, the tension hasn't just started. Some observers have suggested that Mr. Macron and his government should have anticipated the trouble.
I think everybody I have spoken to who's an expert in the region has said exactly that, that, you know, trying to push through this vote, which a lot of people say doesn't fit with the Noumea Accord and the view of trying to become, you know, more autonomous. But at the same time, Macron has made very clear that he wants to have more influence in the region. And so that goes against, obviously, that push for more independence. But I think the fact that this was debated in Parliament, I don't think came as any surprise that this sort of reaction came about it. So now that's the biggest challenge, is to try and, you know, bridge that divide and bring New Caledonia together again.
Katie Watson. In France itself, police have arrested a man who they say they believe was planning an attack during the Olympic torch relay in Bordeaux. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
The 26-year-old, named only as Alex G, posted a message online in support of the so-called incel killer Elliot Rodger, who 10 years ago murdered six people in California, citing his hatred of women and inability to get a girlfriend. This was picked up by an Interior Ministry agency which monitors online extremism. According to police quoted in the French media, on his arrest, the man admitted planning an attack, though without giving detail of time or place. It was the Interior Minister, Gérard Darmanin, who said in a message on Twitter X that the police had foiled a planned attack during the passage of the Olympic flame on Thursday in Bordeaux. Telephones and a non-lethal self-defence revolver were found at the man's home.
Hugh Schofield. And we end this edition of the Global News podcast with the story of an 18th century Spanish warship. Rather more than 300 years ago, the ship known as the San Jose was attacked by a British warship off the coast of South America. The San Jose sank to the bottom of the sea, taking with it treasure now worth billions of dollars. 9 years ago, the wreck was rediscovered, sparking another battle, this time over who owned it, and more crucially, the treasure on board. Now the Colombian government has declared the site a protected archaeological area. Ella Bicknell reports.
For more than 300 years, the location of the San Jose was unknown. thought to be in Davy Jones' locker, lost in an oceanic abyss. It was a 64-gun, three-masted galleon, a mainstay of the Spanish Armada. That was until it was sunk by the British in 1708 off the coast of what is now Colombia. On board, 600 sailors and a treasure trove of gold, silver and emeralds, as well as 11 million pesos in coins. The wreck and its treasure, found in 2015, are estimated to be worth billions of dollars, which is why it's been embroiled in legal disputes over ownership. Spain insisted the bounty was its, since it was a Spanish warship and Spanish soldiers lost at sea. But Bolivia's indigenous Caracara nation say the treasure belongs to them, as their ancestors were forced to mine the precious metals. Even an American salvage company wants a piece, claiming it first spotted the vessel more than 40 years ago.
This isn't just a treasure with economic value. It's more than that. It has cultural importance.
That's Colombia's Minister of Culture, Juan Correa. He says the discovery has been marred by greed, today declaring a protected archaeological area around the site.
This galleon signifies a crossing of cultures, history and memories, which includes the original people of Latin America, and also the genocide that happened there, the enslaving of thousands and thousands of people, human beings, who were brought here from Africa under the worst conditions imaginable.
Next, Colombia will hope to launch a deep water expedition involving a remotely operated robot diving to the depths of 600 metres, taking photos of the wreckage for scientific research. Scientists say they have no plans to take samples, promising a non-invasive operation. Any salvage will come later. For now, the treasure will stay buried.
And that was Ella Bicknell. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Julian Farmer. The producer was Anna Murphy. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.